The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast October 1st, 2024. All right, good afternoon, and welcome to Bookmarked on KCSM, your true community radio station, which I'm sure the nice man just told you. Today, the book under discussion is Gilead by Marilyn Robinson, and I am very happy to welcome back one of my regular guests, Chris Gardner.
Hello, hello. I'm delighted to be here.
All right. Well, I'm delighted to have you. Chris is Associate Professor of English and Dual Credit Liaison at Austin Community College and is also a member of our KCSM Governing Board and is Chair of the Programming Committee. Marilyn Robinson is an American novelist and essayist, best known for Housekeeping from 1980 and this book, Gilead, which came out in 2004 and won the 2005 Pulitzer Prize. Her other novels are Home, Lila, and Jack, and all of those feature the setting and characters from this novel, Gilead. She's also written many nonfiction books along with articles, essays, and reviews. She writes about the relationship between religion and science, U.S. history, nuclear pollution, John Calvin, contemporary American politics, and other subjects. And when you read this, well, there's nothing about nuclear pollution in this book, but all the rest
None of
them
that.
Figure into this novel.
Everything else appropriately
much,
represented.
Yeah. As usual, I will attempt a summary, and you can always add to it. It's set in 1956. It's an extended letter, document, memoir written by the Congregationalist minister, John Ames, to his seven-year-old son. It's to be read when the boy is an adult. Reverend Ames is, actually he turns 77 in the course of the narrative, and he's writing because he's suffering from a terminal heart ailment and will not be around to raise his son. He writes about his father, about his grandfather, who's a fiery abolitionist preacher, who fought with John Brown. He writes about his faith. He writes about his joy in marrying a much younger woman and having a child late in life. He talks a lot about his difficult relationship with John Ames Boughton, who refers to as Jack. Jack is the son of a lifelong friend of John Ames, and he was named after John Ames. But in some ways, he seems almost like his antithesis. I mean, he's an unbeliever. He's made some mistakes. He has a current difficulty in his life. Anything to add on the summary?
I think that's a good and complete summary. I think of this primarily as a book about fathers and sons. We see a great many different paternal relationships. Everything from the early biblical stories of Abraham to the foundational father and son relationship of God and Christ and God and all Christian believers, and then a great many permutations of earthly father-son relationships, some of them literal, some of them assumed or metaphorical. He very much comes to treat Jack like his own son, though he is not literally so. And watching the interplay of all of those different father and son relationships and the ways they do or don't live up to one another's expectations, and the ways they do and don't disappoint each other is a lot of the fun of this otherwise very still novel.
It is a very still novel.
Gilead is a tiny town like John Ames himself. We never leave it through the course of the narrative. We do, I guess, take a jaunt to Kansas with him when he is a 12-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. But during the time of the novel, which does take place in real time because it's epistolary in this way, we never leave Gilead. And
right.
He himself has hardly, if ever, done so in his life. It's one of the things that distinguishes him from his own father and from his grandfather. And we sit kind of patiently with these relationships mm-hmm. and watch them develop in this kind of backwater.
Right. Well, I can think of a number of directions I want to go from this, but I did want to. I always have to know why you chose this book.
I chose this book because the New York Times published their list of the 100 best novels of the new century, and this is one that I had on the shelf that I had never read. So mm-hmm. I had a small handful of books that I've had in my to-be-read pile for a long time, and I pulled them off the shelf, and this is the first of those that I finally got to. My wife read it years ago and raved about it, and now I finally understand why.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you've done that. I want to go back to what you said about it's a brilliant book. The prose is exquisite, but I did find myself wondering as I read it. As you say, you're sitting in this little town, listening to this old guy. You spend most of your time in the little town, and he's not just doing a narrating action, but he's stopping to reflect on whether there's a God or not, or all kinds of on what it's like to die, on, and certainly on parenthood in many, many ways, and there's no plot to speak of, and I couldn't help wondering if there are people speaking of it on being on the shelf who bought it and started it, and you know where it's gathering dust, because it is, as you point out, it's. Yeah, I saw something that said it was like one of the second greatest American novel ever written, or something like that. It's clearly considered a classic now. So, I mean, and you kind of already touched on this, but what did you think about it as a novel?
So I think that it can be. I can imagine this novel frustrating a great many readers.
Yeah, even good astute readers.
Absolutely,
you know?
Because it is deliberately discursive, because we are looking at his diaristic thoughts day by day, they're not artfully arranged by that narrator. They're very artfully arranged by Robinson, who allows him the time to say things like, well, I think you've heard all you need to hear about Jack Boughton now, about mm-hmm. halfway through the novel, and then the rest of the novel is still all about Jack Boughton. He is constantly repeating and retelling crucial moments of his life, and we get tiny iterations of these things and tiny additions with each new iteration. It is, in that way, a fascinating novel structurally, if you are interested in studying a novel structurally, which I am.
Yeah.
But I can see a lot of other readers being put off by his.
Yeah, I mean, you're just sitting with this old guy,
who is
really
falling into homily every 20 pages.
Yeah.
It begins, at least, as his instructive set of thoughts for this son. I won't be here to raise this son. This document will do the work that I can't do myself. And he puts a lot of weight on the document in that way. But halfway through, life takes over. Yeah. Halfway through, his old nemesis, his namesake, John Ames Boughton, comes back to town. And at some point, he has the realization, having reread some of his thoughts himself, that life has intruded, and his story has become something active instead of something reflective.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that she does so wonderfully, though, is that there's a lot of reflection and talk and things that make you think, but you're also definitely dealing with a real person. Every once in a while, he gets really off on a tangent. And I think she means it, as you say, I think she means it that way.
Yeah, you know? I'm fairly bowled over by this book, and I don't believe that there is a single word left awry. It is so carefully done. It's been a while since I read a novel and was this impressed with it. As I said off air, I picked it up for the first time 2 weeks ago, and I've now read it twice and a half, maybe.
I think I would like to. I only read it once. I think I would like to read it again. I wonder, there's a 20-year gap between her first novel, Housekeeping, which was also very well received, and this one, and I'm wondering if it took her 20 years to write it.
Yeah. I know she did some nonfiction work in the gap, but it took her that long to return to a novel.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I want to start with the history part. It and with with any good novel, pretty much everything is connected, so anything you talk about leads you into anything else, so it's hard to decide, well, you know, let's do these things in this order. And also because she is so good at making, in this case, at making stuff you might have heard about in a history class come to life in the presence of these characters. Mm-hmm. According to, but here's a summary. I never do a show without Wikipedia, and this is no exception, okay? According to Robinson, the fictional town of Gilead, Gilead means hill of testimony in the Bible, and it is, I knew it was a biblical word. It's based on the real town of Tabor, Iowa, which is located in the southwest corner of the state and well known for its importance in the abolition movement. Likewise, the character of the narrator's grandfather is loosely based on the real-life story of John Todd, a Congregationalist minister from Tabor who was a conductor on the Underground Railroad, who supplied weapons, supplies, and ammunition used by abolitionist John Brown in his invasion of Missouri in 1857 to free a group of enslaved people. That one I never heard about. And later, without Todd's knowledge or involvement, in his 1859 raid on the U.S. military arsenal at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. And it certainly deepened my sense of, my rather limited sense of the history of that time, particularly the whole bleeding Kansas thing. Did it do that for you? Did you look up background?
This is the second time in my life I have thought about Kansas. Yes.
Yeah.
That history is... is no longer textbook for me. I knew something of the Free Soilers, and I knew that Kansas was in dispute as it was joining the Union.
Right.
But I never had a face to put to any of that. And this family, led by the grandfather, has come to Kansas for expressly this purpose. They are Free Soilers. They've come from Maine.
Right.
Evidently, a great many people came from Maine to Kansas. To this very end. And it's that grandfather that starts kind of the cavalcade of paternal relationships that we see. He is fervent in his belief. He is, as my students would say, a lot. And he believes that he has been touched by God, literally, has felt the hand of the Lord on his shoulder. He is a man who sees visions. He loses an eye fighting in the battle surrounding the Civil War, and in doing so begins to see an increasing number of visions on the side of that blinded eye. Our narrator eventually says of him, "It was the most natural thing in the world that my grandfather's grave would look like a place where someone tried to smother a fire." And it's a lovely sentence.
Yeah.
And it's exactly who he is. He is on fire with righteousness every minute of his life. And that righteousness, delivered at the pulpit as fiery oratory, becomes blasts from a pistol the second he steps away from the pulpit.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he is very... put your good eye where your mouth is about it, I guess. To ruin a phrase.
But one of the wonderful things is there's a kind of ambivalence about him. I mean, he's admirable, but he's not unequivocally admired. He'd fallen asleep by the fire. This is one of his visions, worn out from a day helping his father pull stumps. Someone touched him on the shoulder. And when he looked up, there was the Lord holding out his arms to him, which were bound in chains. My grandfather said those irons had rankled right down to his bones. He told me that, as the saddest fact, eyed me with the one seraph eye he had, the old grief fresh in it. He said he knew then that he had to come to Kansas and make himself useful in the cause of abolition. To be useful was the best thing the old men ever hoped for themselves, and to be aimless was their worst fear, he says. When I spoke to my father about the vision he described to me, my father just nodded and said, "It was the times." and I took comfort in the assurance. He seemed to want to assure me that I need not fear that the Lord would come to me with his sorrows. But, there's kind of ambivalence. Does she want us to admire this? You know, it's the beginning of that father-son chain in some ways, because the father has a lot of reservations about his father, although he risks his own and his son's life to go and find his grave.
He does. So our narrator, John Ames, then, is left with the legacy of both of these men, left with his father, his grandfather, who has been touched by the Lord and unleashes the Lord's fury on anyone who would support slavery and fights very literally in the name of that cause. It's that fury and that violence that turns his father, the son of the grandfather, into a pacifist.
Yeah.
So he inherits both of these traditions, and it seems among the many things that drives him to stasis. He chooses this very small life. He chooses Gilead, despite the yearnings of his father, his mother, his brother, all of whom tell him this is a parochial backwater. There's so much more to the world. You're living in a forgotten time. You've got to get out of here. And he instead seems to choose stasis. And I wonder how much of that is a reaction to those two opposing forces.
Yeah.
His grandfather is very much a father to him still. He's very much a part of his raising.
Mm-hmm.
And between violence and pacifism, he seems to choose stasis, and in doing so chooses neither.
Oh, I love that. I hadn't thought of that. I had certainly thought about the kind of the tension, you know. His father, that is, the grandfather, had preached his people into the war, saying while there was slavery, there was no peace, but only a war of the armed and powerful against the captive and defenseless. He would say, peace will come only when that war ends, so the God of peace calls upon us to end it. He said all this with the gun in his belt, and everyone there always shouted, amen, even the littlest children.
Even the littlest children. And this is part of what abhors the narrator's father, that he sits and watches his father with a gun on his hip preach from the pulpit to a congregation that is almost entirely women, because
yeah.
their husbands have been lost to the violence that his father is still screaming for.
Yeah.
And this is what turns him away, and he goes and sits with the Quakers
yeah.
and embraces pacifism. He does eventually come back to the church, but he does so only at the behest of his mother and somewhat begrudgingly.
Yeah.
So,
there, yeah, in that passage, the father is looking at a piece of needlework on the wall in the church.
Mm.
The Lord our God is a purifying fire. I suppose that is why I always think of my grandfather's church as the one struck by lightning, as in fact it was. My father said it was that banner that had sent him off to sit with the Quakers. He said the very last word he would have applied to war, once he had a good look at it, was purifying, and the thought that these women could believe the world was any way any purer for the loss of their own sons and husbands was appalling to him. He stood there looking at it, visibly displeased by it, apparently because one of the women said to him, it's just a bit of scripture. I beg your pardon, ma'am. No, that is not scripture.
And then she says,
yeah, well, then it certainly ought to be. And of course, it was terrible in his mind that she could have thought such a thing.
Yeah.
Yet if these precise words don't occur in the Bible, there are passages that they could be said to summarize very well. But I love your idea that being pulled in these two directions is part of why he just remains in this small town. I mean, I thought of that as even though other people seem to think that he might have had or done better with another life, I considered that the text was sort of rejoicing in what he'd done and saying, look at all the beauty in these small things. But I don't know, maybe there is a kind of a limitation there too.
I think it's both and the more I read and reread, the more I saw our narrator as left up for a variety of different criticisms. He insists himself over and over that he is a very angry man,
mm-hmm.
But he hardly, if ever, acts on that anger. His wife, in a crucial moment in a late scene, talks about this exactly, about how he never speaks an ill word of anyone.
Yeah.
How he never takes an angry action against anyone. So something of his grandfather's fire is in him, but he won't embrace that. And something of his father's pacifism is in him, but he won't embrace that either. When he has the chance to deliver his own sermon about World War I and the Spanish flu and the way he believes this has been sent as a message to us to stay out, that there mm-hmm. is no good in sending young men off to war, he faces a similar congregation. He looks out on a congregation of women and he feels their losses and he says, this is not the audience.
Yeah.
They don't need to hear me say this. They feel the same way I do. And he takes what he later says is the only sermon he might have been proud to stand up for at the end of his life, and he drops it in the fire and burns it without ever delivering that one.
Yeah.
All the others he keeps stacked in boxes, bending the boards upstairs. But that one he lets go.
Those sermons. I want to share the actual language of the book, so I did have that one that picked out and a quote from the sermon, although it sort of reiterates what you said, but I like the actual language. Mm-hmm. I wrote a sermon about it. I meant to say, that these deaths, that is, from the Spanish flu, were rescuing foolish young men from the consequences of their own ignorance and courage, that the Lord was gathering them in before they could go off and commit murder against their brothers. And I said that their deaths were a sign and a warning to the rest of us that desire for war would bring the consequences of war, because there is no ocean big enough to protect us from the Lord's judgment when we decide to hammer our plowshares into swords and our pruning hooks into spears in contempt of the will and the grace of God. It was quite a sermon, I believe, but my courage failed.
Though.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's him, and that's the book, in a sense, in that a character will have positive qualities, but then they'll have negative qualities, and you never mm-hmm. quite know. There's always a lot of ambivalence.
Which is to say, everyone here feels quite real to me.
Oh, yes.
Even the characters that are left largely mysterious,
mm-hmm.
I feel that the mystery underneath is a very human mystery.
Yeah. All right, we are about up on our first break.
On the radio, this is the Sweet Honey Bear Blues on Tuesday at 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock. You got me giving you what you just didn't know you needed.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections. Now on exhibition, I Pray You Survive,
Mics are back on.
Writing on the Edge. The Whitliff explores how our best writers have personally confronted life or death situations, from war to pandemics, race riots, and murder, to create their groundbreaking work. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please contact us at thewhitliffcollections.txstate.com.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where we are talking about the American classic Gilead by Marilynne Robinson with Chris Gardner. And we were just sort of trying to decide in the break whether we wanted to mention, there is funny stuff in here. I think maybe we should, because we make it sound like a terribly serious novel. And one of the, and even something funny associated with the grandfather, who apparently tells this story as intended to be funny, and there are other things. In any case, I'll try to summarize it. In some forgotten little abolitionist settlement around here, as soon as the people set up a dry goods store and on the other side of the road, and one side of the road and a livery stable on the other, they set about building a tunnel. Tunneling was a popular activity at that time, and a good deal of ingenuity went into devising hiding places and routes of escape. When they'd just about finished their digging, a stranger on a big black horse came through town. He paused in exactly the wrong spot to ask the name of the place, and he and his horse sank right through the mud road into the tunnel. When the dust settled, the horse was standing more or less shoulder deep in a hole. The man climbed off him and walked around and around him in a kind of wonderment, not drawing any conclusions at all, try as he might. And when the people came out to ponder this calamity, took note of his bewilderment, they thought it best to be bewildered too. So they just stood there with their arms folding, saying, "If that's not the dangdest thing," or words to that effect, and they discussed on the risk that went with owning such a large horse.
And proceeds in increasing absurdity from that moment forward as they try to figure out how to get this guy out of town without giving away the secret of the tunnel. They eventually lift the town up and move it down the street a little bit and let that turn into a seasonal creek.
So nobody will know that the tunnel was there. Yep. And to make a funny story out of anything is sort of as serious as that. And there is, as I remember, there is one escaped slave in town who leaves, and he is presented as watching this whole spectacle and trying desperately not to laugh,
mm-hmm.
which he finally does.
And when he leaves, they chase him out of town to make sure he's okay.
Yeah.
And he's like, "I'll be okay if y'all will just leave me alone. Y'all cannot be trusted." There's a great late scene with the grandfather, too, who is seated at the back of the Presbyterian church one evening. And this is not his church, mind you. And the offering goes around, and it gets to him in the back of the church. And he takes his hat off and takes the whole offering plate and just dumps it right into his hat and passes the plate on. And
that's right. That's his. That's one of his the grandfather's things, is that he takes stuff and he gives it away.
I mean, he gives it away. Yeah, he can't be denied anything.
Yeah.
If someone asks something of him, he will give and give and give and give and give. The clothes off the line, everything that he has, he will give away. This he thinks of as some kind of punishment. He always thought the Presbyterians were hoarders.
Oh.
They were just a little greedy. Yeah. So he will take that money and pass it directly on to someone who needs it.
Denominations, actually, he doesn't, if I'm correct, she doesn't identify John Ames as a Congregationalist, mm-hmm. or does she?
I don't.
You know,
I missed it. If it's so subtle enough,
because
it passed me.
There are mentions of other denominations, like the Presbyterians do this, and there were the Methodists over here, and maybe down the road there was. I think there were even some Catholics, Lutherans. Yeah, his little friend is identified as being from a Lutheran family.
Yep.
So I kept thinking, and finally I sort of guessed Congregationalist, and so when I finally looked it up, I thought, oh, I was right, whatever that is. And I suppose that would matter. What makes them distinctive, supposedly, as a Protestant denomination is that, according as the name suggests, the individual congregation has autonomy, and there's something autonomous about all these people.
Yeah, I feel certain that those distinctions mean a great deal more to some readers than they do to me. I just appreciate the moment when his father is preaching and they leave the windows of the church open so they can hear the Methodists down at the river singing that old rugged cross.
Yeah.
They don't sing themselves, but they will leave the windows open and let someone else do the singing for them.
Yeah, I wonder what your take is on a key in the relationship in this whole father-son thing that you point out so well is the trip that the John and his father take, because the grandfather has finally gone off to Kansas and they don't know exactly where he's gone, but they found out that he has died, and they go looking for his grave. And Kansas is in terrible shape. I mean, this is what, like 12 years after the Civil War or something like that.
That sounds right.
Yeah, and it's
deep in drought.
Yeah, they're having a drought, and you know, my father said, and they don't even have any food. They take things. My father was, as he said at the time, intending to glean a few overgrown carrots. He left a dime on the stoop to pay for whatever we could find to steal, which was always little enough. And he's laughing because a farmer actually took a shot at him.
Mm-hmm.
That was something to see, my father in his shirt sleeves straddling a rickety old garden fence with a hank of carrot tops in his hand and a fellow behind him taking aim. We took off into the brush, and when we decided he wasn't going to follow us, We sat down on the ground, and my father scraped the dirt off the carrot with his knife and cut it up into pieces and set them on the crown of his hat, which he'd put between us like a table. And then he commenced to say grace, which he never failed to do. He said, "For all that we are about to receive." And then we both started laughing until the tears were pouring down. And that's one of those wonderful, wonderful moments in which something really harrowing turns out to be funny.
He recognizes only in retrospect how desperately he alone he would have been had his father been shot by the person who took a pop at him. So his father and his grandfather have harsh words, and his grandfather just up and leaves town. I mean, seems immediate. Mm-hmm. And no one really even has a chance to say goodbye. And then that's the last they see of him. And his father can't sit with that. He can't let that be the last note. It was a complicated relationship that he had with his father's. They were ideologically at odds, and he eventually left his own father's church, but he can't let the relationship sit that way. He owes something more to his father. Mm-hmm. And they go down, and they do eventually find a very meager grave in Kansas, and his father kneels down to pray, and our narrator says, "Every prayer seemed long to me at that age, and I was truly bone tired." His father is going on and on and on. "I tried to keep my eyes closed, but after a while I had to look around a little, and this is something I remember very well. At first, I thought I saw the sun setting in the east." I knew where east was, because the sun was just over the horizon when we got there that morning. "Then I realized that what I saw was a full moon rising just as the sun was going down. Each of them was standing on its edge with the most wonderful light between them. I suppose because they were both so bright, you couldn't get a clear look at them, and that grave and my father and I were exactly between them, which seemed amazing to me at the time, since I hadn't given much thought to the nature of the horizon. My father said, 'I never would have thought this place could be beautiful. I'm glad to know that.'" Mm-hmm. And I think that there's, I think that's a lovely image, and I'm still trying to figure out all of the things that it does in this novel. But I think one of them is that these become the father and the son, mm-hmm. that the moon is a reflection of the sun, just as the sun is a reflection of the father. And they are here pegged between. They are seated at the grave of the grandfather, and the two living generations are stuck between these two reflective beings, mm-hmm. as they both shine on the two of them, and they're both trying to make some kind of peace with this. His father trying to pray in the best way he knows how, despite the fact that he and his own father shared a different religious view, and the son trying his best he can to be patient through the process and not distract it with his eye toward beauty. And maybe that's a moment to talk about all of the beauty that John Ames sees in the world.
Oh, yeah.
He does stay home and lives a very small life, but he's constantly startled by beauty and has a really careful eye. He says at some point, "I've always paid great attention to light," and maybe this is where it starts for him. Yeah. There are moments in this novel where he wakes up early and goes to church just so he can watch the light enter the building. There are a half dozen really beautiful scenes about water, which has all kinds of power in this novel, which is also often concerning itself with baptism and blessing. There's a one particular moment where he sees a couple walking down the road, and the gentleman jumps up and grabs a wet branch and shakes it, and the droplets of water fall on them in a way that just leaves him stunned. There's another moment of a mother and daughter at the river doing the same thing. He has a dream of his grandfather filling his hat with water, flinging it into the air. He watches the water and the light interact when his own son is playing in the sprinkler with the neighbor boy. Yeah. And he doesn't quite find the language to explain just how beautiful this is to him. And I think it's one of the mysterious and mystical things that Robinson wrestles with here.
Yeah.
That there is something just beyond beauty that means more than we can say. And one of the things I love best about this novel is how often she lets us sit with that mystery mm-hmm. without over-explaining and thereby reducing it for us.
Yeah, I love that. And you said he doesn't find that John Ames doesn't quite find the words, but I certainly felt like I shared that experience, and it reminded me of, you know, looking out my window at the deer feeding in the dappled shade outside my kitchen window.
Yeah.
You know,
and if I could lightly correct myself,
sure.
He doesn't believe that he finds the words. The words that he finds are, for me, stunning.
Yeah.
And those are some of my favorite moments of the novel, just in their simple beauty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't get a... Maybe that's one of the reasons why, at least why I find it memorable. You don't always get a lot of joy in fiction, at least not much, so much recently. You want to talk about... John Ames' marriages. He marries young. He marries a girl that he's known since childhood. He has mm-hmm. some nice memories of her as a kind of a strong person. He remembers her as a child jumping rope and things like that.
Yeah.
But he has not married again until this woman who is... not young, but much, much younger than he, just sort of walks into the church. And he describes the time as dark and lonely, but and this is, of course, typical of how he seems to think. I could have married again while I was still young. A congregation likes to have a married minister, and I was introduced to every niece and sister-in-law in 100 miles. In retrospect, I'm glad for whatever reluctance it was that kept me alone until your mother came. Now that I look back, it seems to me that in all that deep darkness, a miracle was preparing. So I am right to remember it as a blessed time, although he has called it a dark and lonely time, and myself as waiting in confidence, even if I had no idea what I was waiting for. I do not know what to make of that.
She does. She arrives like a revelation.
Yeah.
She shows up appropriately in a rainstorm,
mm-hmm.
and everything good in his life seems to be connected to water. And here she is, and he is struck. From the first moment he sees her, he can't stop thinking about her, even while he is delivering his sermon. His mm-hmm. next several sermons are all quietly directed at her, even though he doesn't yet know her name.
Yeah.
She skips 1 week, and he is desolate, doesn't even want to deliver the sermon that he is here to deliver about inviting the stranger in, because you never know when that stranger might be an angel.
Yeah.
It's a little
is she
on the
an
nose.
Angel? He does also say, I believe that it was because I write those summons as if Rebecca, and I said that he marries young, but he marries young and loses both his infant daughter and his wife in childbirth, and Rebecca would be the child, the infant. Mm-hmm. I write these sermons as if Rebecca might sometime walk in the door that I was somewhat prepared when your mother walked in, younger than Rebecca would have been, in fact, of course, but not very different from the way I saw her in my mind. It wasn't so much her appearance as the way she seemed as if she didn't belong there, and at the same time as if she was the only one of all of us who really did belong there.
I love that description. I love it.
I love that, too. But we never really... You said all the characters seem real to you, and they do to me, too, but we never really know much about her. We know that she is much less educated, from the way she speaks, mm-hmm. that she is much less educated than he, and that she tends to be kind of quiet, perhaps partly because she is among people who are more educated than she is. She may be a little understandably self-conscious. but she remains a mystery. And although I've noticed that she gets a book of her own after this.
It's the one I'm most excited to read. I think we get suggestions that there is something complicated in her past. Mm-hmm. We get whispered conversations between her and Jack Boughton about the ways that she has lived poor all over the place. He says at some point, I couldn't help but think that Jesus would have spent time with my wife if they had lived at the same time, mm-hmm. which is both a compliment and, of course, a reminder that Jesus didn't spend his time with the classy and wealthy. He spent his time with prostitutes and the destitute. And then she is the one, during one of the conversations with Jack again, who is desperate to know that predestination doesn't mean that a person can't be saved. She is the one that says, after her husband refuses to, a person can change, everything can change. And I'm really interested to read her novel and figure out how she arrived here in this so serious countenance of hers, and how she set her sights on a minister who was 36 years older than she was, because she definitely puts the target on him. She proposes.
She does. It's clear to her that he is in love with her.
Yeah.
You know.
But he says, "I don't know how to thank you for all of this work you've done in my garden." And she says, "Well, you could marry me." And then she walks away, and he has to chase her down and be like, "That's a great idea."
Yeah, it's a mystery. I don't know. We are already up on another break. But do you want to say a quick word about the whole thing about being a minister, about a vocation? As I said, I wish I'd read this in time to invite someone who actually is a minister to come and talk with us about it. You know, about what it means to have a vocation and have your sense of your obligation to your congregation and all of that.
Yeah, and I would love the help parsing the allusions that I know I'm missing. There's a lot happening in this book that I'm not seeing. He dedicates himself so carefully to a life of ideas in this little spot. His mm-hmm. whole life is building up that giant stack of sermons. He mm-hmm. doesn't miss a week. He doesn't go on vacation and ask somebody to fill in. He just sits down every week and tries to put the world into words. And that's the life he has chosen. It is a life of ideas. It is a life of words. And it's a life of trying to say all of these impossible-to-say things.
Yeah.
And there's something really honorable about a quiet life wrestling with the unsayable.
I always think of that when I listen to a sermon, because I think, well, I can prepare a talk on something, I can try to get someone interested in it, I can impart some knowledge, but to inspire them, to make them a better person, to have to do that as well.
It's a high bar.
Oh, yeah. All right, we are up, believe it or not, on another break.
My name is Mason Moore, and you can catch me and my rescue pup, Franklin, every Wednesday at 10 p.m.
Baptism, but you talked
We're bringing
about water,
you any
so
significant
maybe
event
maybe
from the past week.
Baptism, though,
album releases, song
him,
releases, birthdays, deaths,
well,
cultural events,
we can start
nothing
about,
is off limits. We're spanning over 80 years of music history on the weekly show. All genres
when
welcome.
When we get to water. You know.
Find your next favorite song right next to your old one right here on KZSM, True Community Radio.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections. Subscribe to our email list today and stay in the know about all the great events, exhibitions, and news happening at the finest collection of literary, photography, and music holdings in the Southwest. The Whitliff Collections is free and open to the public. We're located on the 7th floor of the Alkeck Library at Texas State University.
Just talked over the mic.
For more information, please contact us at thewhitliffcollections.txt.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where we are talking with Chris Gardner about Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. And I haven't said yet that the opinions on this broadcast are those of the host and guest only, and not those of KZSM or its parent corporation, SMTX CRA. And we are in this last segment, we're up on the part of this novel, I mean, and you identified it wonderfully at the beginning as being very much about fathers and sons. but there is the John Ames is the narrator. John Ames is his anti-son or something. He has a relationship with his namesake, who is the son of his lifelong friend, the Presbyterian minister, Robert Boughton. Robert Boughton lives nearby, and he is dying definitely and is deteriorating badly, and Jack, his son, returns to see him. And in the course of that, he has several conversations with Ames. And I can never figure out the source of... Ames has a deep-seated antipathy to Jack, and it's almost like it's because he is named after him, and in this, and he's taken by surprise. And he talks about, and I should, it's important to say here that Robert Boughton has like seven other children, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Both, you know, four boys and four girls or something like mm-hmm. that. So this is not, you know, this is not the only child of that family by any means. But this child, the child's name, John Ames is asked to baptize the new baby. The child's name was to be Theodore Dwight Weld. I thought that was an excellent name. But then when I asked Boughton, and this must be in the ceremony, by what name do you wish this child to be called? He said, John Ames. I was so surprised that he said the name again with the tears running down his face. And he talks about people crying, I guess because they are touched at this tribute to a lifelong friendship. If I had had even an hour to reflect, I believe my feelings would have been quite different. As it was, my heart froze in me, and I thought, this is not my child, which I had truly never thought of any child before. I don't know exactly what covetous is. And then he says later, I'm trying to be honest. I do feel a burden of guilt toward that child, that man, my namesake. I have never been able to warm to him. Never.
He says,
what is that?
So this book came out 20 years ago, and I don't feel bad spoiling it. I'll say this also. I've read this book 2.5 times now, and I think if I read it 5 or 6 times, I'll understand everything.
Okay.
And be ready to read it a 7th time. So here's where I am right now with Boughton, who I think is the real center of this novel. There is a great deal of this novel that concerns itself with the parable of the prodigal son, the wandering dilettante who comes back and receives all of the father's love, mm-hmm. right? As Ames says early, there's an absolute disjunction between a father's love and our deserving. He thinks in this moment, this is not my child. He'll eventually come to claim this child as his own, claim Jack Boughton as his own in all the ways that matter. He says, in this moment, I'll tell you a perfectly foolish thing. I have thought from time to time that the child felt how coldly I went about his christening, how far my thoughts were from blessing him. And he speaks often in baptism about the way both the infant child is, both the infant child and the officiant are blessed by the process. Okay. And this is part of that magic of water that he sees. And something happens here. He believes very strongly in sacrament here and elsewhere. And this is a holy rite, and something that he can't quite explain happens. But he is blessed by giving the blessing. And here, he's not focused. He's thrown off his game by this late renaming, and he's not present in the moment. And whatever magic is supposed to happen there doesn't happen. And so I think Jack Boughton is, he's a rambunctious child. He loves to steal things that he knows you love and just hide them for a while and then put them back somewhere strange. He devises a way to shatter a window entirely without just breaking a piece of it. He has, as the narrator says over and over, a meanness about him.
Yeah.
He at one point steals the narrator's picture of Louisa, his first wife, and he says, "I was as angry about that as I have ever been in my life." And I think that he believes part of Jack's devilment is connected to his own failure here, that this is a failed baptism, and that he's trying for the rest of his life to make up for that. He says all kinds of wretched things about Jack throughout the novel. He says, "I have never felt that he was fond of me. He is not a man of the highest character. It is hard for me to see good faith in him."
Well, in fairness, Jack is not altogether, I mean, given the rather mean things that you just described, is not altogether a nice person.
No.
And we do learn about, something very hurtful that he has done to someone else as an adult.
Absolutely.
Not to John, but...
There really does seem to be a meanness in him, and Jack is definitely Ames's antagonist.
Yeah.
Right? They are constantly at odds at some point or another. There's what feels like an innocuous line of conversation, and Ames says, "There can't be a single person in the world more difficult to talk to." And he is a constant source of frustration. And for this reverend, who we have said has a wonderful eye for beauty, who sits carefully with the big ideas, who lives this small and contemplative life, but still promises us that he's an angry man, for him to wrestle with Jack Boughton, who returns in the middle of this narrative, returns to Gilead in the middle and kind of takes over what his son thought was his begats. He was just going to tell him the long history of the family. And Jack quickly takes this over, and it becomes not sermonistic but diaristic as he is processing all his complicated feelings about Jack as he goes. And I think that's where I sit with this right now. I think that this baptism is in some way failed, and that he feels responsible for it, and that is part of the devilment that he sees in Jack, and that he has got to find it in his heart to be as forgiving as God the Father would be.
Yeah.
He's got to be as forgiving as his mortal father is, as Jack's mortal father is, who again, in that prodigal son model, can forgive anything of this most disruptive of children. All his other children are out in the world doing good works.
Yes.
And this is the only child that he actually wants to hear about.
Yeah.
And I think that's what our narrator has to learn. That he's got to come to love in a way that he has always told everyone else to love.
Yeah.
And he finds it really difficult.
I just want to revisit why it's difficult for him and why the baptism has failed. I mean, it's because he's thrown off and distracted, but he's thrown off and distracted because the child is named after him when he didn't expect it. And I'm wondering if that's supposed to be him, then there's no interaction or in other words, he's not, you talked about the sacrament being an exchange between two different beings, but here he's being told that this is an infant John Ames, and somehow, I don't know, I'm groping at that, but because it seems very, a lot of things in here are very mysterious, and that's certainly one of them. I even got confused because he refers to Jack often as young Boughton, and I thought for a while that was for Robert, another one of Robert Boughton's sons, because there must be other people who are young Boughton, but only Jack gets to be called that.
Yeah, and only Jack weighs in on our narrative. We meet Glory, Jack's sister, who is here doing all of the hard work while Jack runs around. Yeah, there's another moment when they talk about seeing your own face in your child as a kind of consecration. Oh, no, sorry. No, it has something to do with incarnation. Sorry about that. And there's that. And I think that he is so touched by this because he has lived in this loneliness for all of these years. He loses his wife. He loses his daughter in the same moment. He's not even there when it happens.
Right.
And he is left with this this lonely life that he ultimately embraces, and he thinks that he's living, you know, kind of invisibly. Mm-hmm. And here his friend sees him. He says, mm-hmm. sometimes when I blessed a child, I realized how much I was missing in my life. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he knows how seen he is. So when his friend gives him this gift, and mm-hmm. then he looks up and realizes that everybody in the congregation knows how much this means and knows why Boughton is doing this, I think that he feels seen in a way that he's not entirely comfortable with. And that is part of what's so disruptive to yeah. him here. He believes that he doesn't deserve this. And maybe in some way that he, in part, deserved to be alone, deserved to be childless. I think he has accepted that as his lot in life. And Boughton says, but you don't have to. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really touching and moving for him. And unfortunately, it moves him out of rather than into the moment.
Yeah.
He feels on stage and thereby performs the act instead of being in the action.
Yeah. But he does resolve after some difficult conversations, including about, and it's interesting that he seems to be obsessing over something bad that Jack has done, but really what he talks about all the time is whether the fact that Jack doesn't believe in God. And we've only got 4 minutes left.
We do.
What, if anything, would you like to, what is the one last thing that you'd like to say about this?
Oh, Lord. It's a knockout novel. It is a novel that I am going to read for the rest of my life, I think. I haven't fallen for a book like this in a long time.
Oh, good.
If we've just got a few moments, then I'm going to read a couple of lines if I can.
Okay,
because
and I'll make a quick comment. I liked what it said about religion, how it was intrusive to assume anything about someone else's belief. And I also liked, particularly, I guess, because I had a hard time getting over COVID, and I'm something not past my sell-by date, but certainly vintage. I liked the depiction of the man coping with his imminent death.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't gloomy exactly. It was beautiful. Okay, cool.
And then I would, if I get to, three lines. We participate in being without remainder, no breath, no thought. No wart or whisker is not as sunk in being as it could be. I'm going to sit with that for a long time. My favorite line of the novel, cataract that this world is, it is remarkable to consider what does abide in it. Cataract there being the rushing torrent of water rather than the eye condition.
Or the rushing torrent of experience that comes over one.
It all comes passing. And then one more real quickly.
Sure.
Wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration. And if John Ames has anything to convince us of, it might be that.
Yeah. Yeah. Read that one again and then we'll close.
Wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration.
All right. Well, Chris Gardner, thank you for once again being my guest, and thank you so much for suggesting this book. And as always, thank you for listening.